From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We're just a few weeks into the NFL season. It's a time of transition for the Atlanta Falcons in particular. This is their last year at the Georgia Dome before they move to the new Mercedes-Benz Stadium that's currently being built downtown. That $1.6 billion stadium is one of the reasons why Atlanta was picked to host the Super Bowl in 2019. Last month, I spoke with team owner Arthur Blank about the new arena and why he felt it was important to keep the Falcons in downtown Atlanta rather than move outside the city like the Braves.
Number one, I think the reason we selected the site that we did is that it's an incredible location that represents the heart and the soul of downtown Atlanta. The problem is, you think of it in terms of the heart, there's a part of it, if you will, to the west that it's not functioning as well as the rest of the heart is, and that's the west side. And so part of our commitment is not only to build the finest sports entertainment venue in the United States, if not the world, which we're in the process of doing, but to make the changes in terms of the west side. And we spent, you know, the better part of 3 years before talking to the folks that are living in those communities. And basically what they told us is that what they were looking for is not too unlike almost any American family would say. They want jobs. They want to make sure their kids are going to good public schools. They want to live in safe communities. They want to make sure the communities are healthy and the environment around them is clean and respectable. And so I think that we've dedicated ourselves, along with many partners, to making changes in all of those areas, some of which are easier to do on a short-term basis, and we've had a lot of short-term successes, and we can point to all those. Others are take a long-term commitment, and we have the right folks aligned on doing that, both in the nonprofit as well as in the profit world, as well as a political system, I would say, here, a mayor that's committed to the same things that we are. So progress is being made. Tremendous progress is being made in the stadium. It'll be done June of next year, and there's been a lot of progress in these communities. When you spend time walking the streets and talking to these folks, almost on a uniform basis, you hear that things are much better than they used to be. Not as good as you want them to be, but much better than they used to be. And that's the trend line we want to continue.
So how do you respond to the debate now over who should pay for stadiums? This was brought into the headlines this summer by player Richard Sherman, but it's been a debate for a very long time.
It has been.
Yeah, and I want to read this comment from a senior fellow at the Stanford Institute for Economic Policy Research. You probably read his research, Roger Knoll, and he says, NFL stadiums do not generate significant local economic growth, and the incremental tax revenue is not sufficient to cover any significant financial contribution by the city. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think you can point to another group of so-called the experts who would respond differently, but I would say my own viewpoint is that I think it's where you position the stadium. I mean, I think if you put it out in the middle of, I don't want to say nowhere, but we had opportunities in some counties that really had no connection, if you will, to the heart of Atlanta, to the soul of Atlanta. I think when you make a commitment to build a stadium that's right in the middle of the population, in this case, close to Centennial Park, close to the West Side, close to the largest aquarium in the United States, the National Human and Civil Rights Museum, the College Hall of Fame, you begin to reach what I call Malcolm Gladwell's version of the tipping point, where the city and the center of the city becomes a place of attraction for guests to come and stay for a period of time. And in our case, what we're trying to do beyond the stadium itself, which will host, let's say, 50 great events a year, NFL games, soccer events, concerts, and the like, the other 300 days a year or so, we're going to activate all the arcades and plazas around the stadium connected to Centennial Park, which is to the east where the Olympics were, and to the west where the West Side is, and to the Beltline, which surrounds Atlanta, and to Mims Park, which is a old historic park that we're helping restore in the West Side area, and make sure those areas on the other days have the sense of community with theater, with music, with dance, with arts, with a variety of activities, food, to make sure that that area becomes a downtown urban park. So whether you live in that area or you come down for the day and spend time in that whole area, great cities, in my opinion, as I travel the world, and I'm sure you and a lot of our listeners do, travel the world, you see great cities have great parks. Part of what we're trying to develop here is a downtown version of Piedmont Park, which is our version of Central Park in Atlanta, but a downtown version, an urban version of that.
And the stadium will get double duty even just with sports teams. I want to play you this comment from Darren Eels. He's the team president of your new soccer club, Atlanta United, and here's what he had to say.
we've got a chance to rewrite the narrative of Atlanta. I think as we come into 2017, a lot of stories are going to be written about the amazing phenomenon of the city getting behind the team. And I'm hoping that that helps to sort of change this. The narrative is incorrect that Atlanta doesn't support its teams. I mean, it's crazy to say that when you look at what we've done here. The Falcons sell out their stadium week after week. So I think there's this lazy journalism almost that Atlanta's not really a sports city, which is not really getting behind the truth.
What makes you think that now is a good time for soccer in Atlanta?
Atlanta's been a huge hotbed for soccer for a long period of time. There are over 55,000 young folks that play soccer in Atlanta. We don't have a head coach. We have seven with another 30 players to come. And the players we have are from all over the world. We haven't announced our kit yet, which is our uniform, and yet we have 32,000 founding members have made deposits on season tickets, which is the highest number in the history of Major League Soccer. We've already started our youth academy, which is the five teams that will play for us, represent us, starting in September, the first time that's ever been done in the history where the youth academy is playing before the professional team is playing. So all the indications are that we're going to have a great success in Atlanta. And it's a wonderful sport. It's a worldwide sport, obviously. One of the attractions is that the stadium has been designed to accommodate soccer on a FIFA standard basis so that when our soccer fans come into the stadium, they will feel like this is a soccer-purposed stadium and not something that's just been converted from the Atlanta Falcons.
My guest is Atlanta Falcons owner, Atlanta United owner, Arthur Blank, and we would love to hear from you, whether you're looking forward to the new stadium, maybe just the Super Bowl or a new soccer team. You can tweet us at OST Talk or comment on Facebook. Arthur, we got this comment from Sam Burnham who says, how long before Mercedes-Benz Stadium becomes outdated and has to be replaced? Will it at least be paid for by then? Some skepticism about the funding and the new stadium.
Sure, of course. And that's a very fair question. And I think, you know, it's not the reason that we selected. It's one of the reasons, I shouldn't say it's not the only reason that Mercedes-Benz made a huge financial commitment to support the naming rights in the stadium. But their slogan is the best or nothing. When you watch their ads on TV or see the newspaper, that matches our core philosophy of the way that we do things. And so this stadium has been built to last for a very long period of time. We haven't valued engineered anything out of the building, zero. We've continued to accept all good ideas. We had some additional time in the front because the land acquisitions took us a little longer than what we had expected initially, a little more complicated. And during that period of time, we continued to develop ideas based on what the fans were telling us. This stadium reflects all of what the fans have been telling us they want to see in a stadium, in terms of design, in terms of amenity, in terms of the way it's going to operate, in terms of food pricing, in terms of the LEED certification. It's going to be the first platinum LEED certification building of this type in the United States, and probably the only one that will get a platinum certification in the future as well, given the fact those standards just continue to be raised. We're going to be the first time in the history of the United States we're going to have the big three, if you will, sporting events lined up year after year, the Super Bowl, the College Final Four, the NCAA Final Four. So we are building a stadium that will last. It reflects what our fans want. It's going to attract and not only house the Atlanta Falcons and Atlanta United, but national events for a very, very long period of time.
That's Atlanta Falcons owner Arthur Blank. I spoke with him in August about the NFL season and the 2019 Super Bowl that will be played here in Atlanta at the team's new Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Years ago, there was no hotter athlete in America than Michael Vick. The show-stopping quarterback drafted by the Atlanta Falcons quickly became one of the biggest celebrities in sports, and he was an icon of Southern hip-hop culture. But his success was soon overshadowed by an animal abuse scandal. Vick pleaded guilty in 2007 to felony dogfighting charges that took place on his property in Virginia. He spent nearly 2 years in prison, and fans in his adopted city were left to question a sports hero they had once idolized. A new five-part documentary by the Bleacher Report chronicles the rise and fall of Michael Vick. And I spoke with Joe Yannarella back in July about that film. He's editor-in-chief of Bleacher Report and executive producer of Vick. Here's a portion of that conversation. As I understand it, this began as another one of the Bleacher Report sort of short films or videos. How did it become a larger documentary?
It started as a narrower digital-friendly featurette in the 5 to 10 minute range. We were specifically focused on the narrative of Michael Vick and his passion for chess in prison, how he took up the game, how it taught him patience and maturity and strategy, and some of the tactical aspects of football that resonated with him. And throughout that, our producer, Johnny Sweet, built a relationship with Michael and some of his reps, and they invited him to go along with them to Frank Beamer's last game at Virginia Tech, who was the coach where Michael was a student there. And then they invited us to accompany them to the state capitol in Pennsylvania, where Mike was lobbying animal cruelty prevention law. And as it turned out, we built a relationship with him over 5 or 6 months, and we got such unprecedented access that we thought this made sense for our first foray into a full-length 50-minute documentary.
So you must have felt that there were things that had not been said. I mean, Michael Vick has been talked about a lot, not only from his just meteoric rise after he became the first quarterback ever to be drafted first overall, first African-American quarterback, I should say, but a lot is written about, you know, the dogfighting charges, his time in prison, even whether or not fans would accept him as he returned to the ball field. So what was left unsaid? What did you discover that you felt was a surprise?
I think what we wanted to offer was holistic perspective. You know, taking all of those different chapters, there was the dynamic athlete that just blew people away. There was this criminal, inhumane act that people couldn't get past and captivated a country. There was the return and the comeback of this athlete again in another chapter. We wanted to give a holistic look at it, and we wanted to revisit removed from that. You know, looking at that whole body of work, looking at the man today, has he changed? What's his perspective? You know, what's changed since this kind of whirlwind of events occurred around this very high-profile athlete?
So let's go back in time before we begin to talk about some of the more recent developments. Remind us of just what an incredible athlete Michael Vick was, because he was and still in many ways is. Can we go back to not just his college career, but then his drafting in 2001 and what he was like on the field?
Yes, he was one of the most dynamic physical presences that ever existed at the quarterback position. You know, his combination of size, speed, arm strength. I mean, there were mobile quarterbacks previous to him, but not mobile quarterbacks who were able to throw the ball 70, 80 yards downfield, run like a wide receiver, elude defensive linemen. It was just breathtaking in his athleticism, and he captured the country and the world of sports with that breathtaking athleticism. And at the same time, he maintained a certain authenticity and realness that attracted him to the hip-hop community, the Atlanta music community. He was very authentic in the same way that Allen Iverson was authentic when he burst on the basketball scene.
So let's hear a comment on this very thing from rapper Capone. He is talking about Vick's connection with hip-hop culture.
Michael Jordan was the greatest of all time, but he wasn't hip-hop. But Mike Vick was every young kid's dream, playing in the slums. He was that relatable. He made you feel like you could play football. Everything Mike did became a metaphor, whether it was I'm quick like Mike Vick, you know what I'm saying? Everything that Mike did became a substance for somebody, an artist to rap about.
And I want to play one more comment. This is from former NFL quarterback Donovan McNabb, and he's explaining why Vick became so beloved in Atlanta and became to symbolize Atlanta.
Atlanta was the bed of hip-hop, beautiful women. It was just the place you go to enjoy. And Mike was the face of Atlanta. And to be honest with you, still is probably the face of Atlanta.
Do you agree with Donovan McNabb there? Do you think he still is in some ways a symbol of Atlanta?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the reasons we decided to do a full length, because there is still a segment of the population that reveres Michael despite everything that went on and him going to prison, that people revere him both for his athleticism, for his connection to the community, for his perceived coolness. You know, this authenticity about him just connected. One of the other rappers said he was just like us, you know, and Lil Wayne said, you know, at that time, if you made a rap video and Mike did not do a cameo in it, your rap video wasn't very cool.
So then we have to move on to the dogfighting charges and the abuse scandal, and the discovery of dogfighting at his property in Virginia was accidental. Some people forget that they were looking for drug paraphernalia from someone else and discovered that happening at his home. But once it occurred, it became a huge topic of conversation. And this is something that comes up, obviously, significantly in your documentary, Joe. How did people, and even Michael Vick himself, how does he put that era of his life into context?
I think he says he takes full ownership and says it was wrong. It says he should have known better. I mean, in no way are we trying to defend his actions, but we wanted to provide some perspective and you know, talk about his upbringing and the apartment complex he lived in where pets weren't allowed, but it was common to have strays that were almost the pets for everyone in the complex, and it wasn't unusual to have dog fighting. And you can't separate the fact the inhumane and criminal nature of what was done, but it was somewhat accepted in those communities. So, but, you know, perspective-based, Michael looks back and says, look, I made mistakes. I was wrong. I shouldn't have done the things I've done. And he's quite remorseful about it. You know, it's difficult to separate those actions from the seemingly mature, responsible, remorseful person he is today, but at least you have some framing and perspective of what led to that.
It sounds like you have at least become convinced that he truly is a changed man. Is that true?
I never like to say definitively that someone has changed. We spent 5 or 6 months with him, and he, from all appearances, was remorseful, mature, took ownership, blamed no one, talked about becoming an agent of change, talked about turning a negative into a positive, spoke very little about football or a football future, and spoke more about how he could turn a negative into a positive. So during that snapshot, he seemed authentic about it, but always hate to take a definitive stance that someone has changed during a short period of time.
Yeah, I can understand that. Let's play another clip from your documentary. Here is ESPN reporter Kelly Naki discussing, she's talking about the psychology behind dogfighting, but what she's really talking about is why this conviction, these allegations were so upsetting to so many people.
Dogs want to please their master. Now you're putting this dog in this position where it's going to be physically harmed, routinely, and psychologically scarred, all because it's trying to please you. You're taking advantage of that and abusing it like a kid, right? Like a child. I think that people equate what he did with child abuse.
And Joe, one of the things that Michael Vick has talked kind of openly about is that the dog fighting was just one aspect of what he called his, I guess, a divorce from reality, that he lost a sense of himself and his upbringing, and all of the attention and celebrity and money kind of made him lose himself. What did you learn about that?
I think that's fairly accurate, Celeste. And Aaron Brooks, his cousin, who was also a former NFL quarterback with the Saints, talked about that in his early 20s, that he was speaking to Michael and saying to him, hey, Michael, you know, life's getting away from you. Things are getting too fast. You're getting in bad situations. You know, it was to the point where Michael was flying back from Atlanta to his home every weekend, even during the football season when he had an off day for this. So he got caught up in a spiral of negative activity that he just felt like he was swept up in and takes full ownership and blame for participating in.
So one of the things I really enjoyed about the documentary is it did remind me, the dogfighting became to so dominate the story of Michael Vick, and that's understandable. But we have in some ways forgotten what an incredible athlete Vick was. Certainly here in Atlanta, he led the Falcons to the playoffs twice. He was selected to 3 Pro Bowls. This is an incredible athlete. But let's fast forward to modern times. And he has now become an advocate for pet safety. He lobbied for a bill that would create misdemeanor penalties for even spectators who watch animal fighting, and then make it a felony for adults to bring kids to fight. And this is a little clip of him serving as an advocate for pet safety.
I appreciate the moment to talk about the very important bill, House Bill 1516, which allows police officers to rescue pets and left in hot cars. I know that I'm an unlikely advocate. I was part of the problem when I was at my lowest. I made a decision to make change, and I stand by that. Now that I can reach people that activists can't reach, I appreciate that.
So how has he then moved forward, do you think? I mean, we know what he was court ordered to do. We know about him serving his time. But how has he personally moved forward from this?
I think he's just become a much more mature, responsible adult. I think during his 20s, he was on a ride of excess, and he did not need to mature because of the circumstances that were around him, and he made incredibly bad choices. I think his prison time was quite sobering for him. He talked about the fact, like, the day he went into prison, having to face his daughter and tell her that he was going away and she wouldn't be able to see him, and realized that it was through no fault of anyone else's but his own. And he vowed that he would never put himself in a situation like that again. So I think there's a certain maturity and sense of purpose that surrounds him today that doesn't necessarily revolve strictly around sports.
Now, Michael Vick is a free agent at this point. What kind of athlete is he now? Has his athleticism or his performance on the field changed?
Absolutely. I mean, at his age and the style of play, he is not the same athlete. And even coming out of prison afterwards, he was challenged to get back to the level he was before. Ironically, he's been known as a backup quarterback candidate that teams want to bring in because he's so mature and he's a real locker room leader and presence that they want to have, which is ironic given all the circumstances that surrounded him. But most teams that are even considering him aren't considering him in an active playing role, but as a backup, knowing he can be a steadying, mature influence around other people in the locker room and step in as necessary. We've heard rumblings the possibility of he could return to Seattle, but he, as stated, it wasn't something he put a lot of emphasis on at this point, whether he was actively going to be playing.
So what are we to take from the story of Michael Vick when we look at other pro athletes, athletes that also might suddenly be confronted with the kind of celebrity and money they weren't prepared for? Is he the kind of cautionary tale that could be useful to other athletes?
Oh, absolutely, Celeste. And I think the bigger question is, does someone deserve a second chance? I think that's for the viewers of the doc to decide on their own. For many people, they cannot separate the very inhumane and criminal act that exists from the man who appears to exist today. For some people, they give the benefit of the doubt for this wonderful athlete they've known and revered. I think everyone has to watch and make their own decisions whether someone who's paid their debt to society, served all the time that was charged with, do they deserve a second chance at redemption to move on with their life?
So and we have about a minute left, but I got to ask you, Joe, is this the beginning of Bleacher Report kind of going the way of ESPN? Are we going to see more long-form documentaries from you?
I think the big question, Celeste, is opportunity-based. I mean, this was such a wonderful opportunity that resonated with our audience that is increasing, that is largely young. And so having a topic within the last 10 years of a dynamic personality and a narrative fit in the digital landscape of how our consumers consume content. So I think we'll look at more opportunities in the future, but I don't think there's any decision saying, okay, now go out and make 6-8 more great documentaries, because then you start to water down the narratives.
That's Joe Iannarella. He's editor-in-chief of Bleacher Report and executive producer of a 5-part documentary about former Atlanta Falcons quarterback Michael Vick. I spoke with him in July. When we watch baseball, it's hard to imagine teams being segregated by race. But even today, there are still athletes and fans who remember a time when that was the way it was. In Macon, a teenager's love for baseball led him to a forgotten history of the Negro League. As GPB's Leah Fleming reports, the Eagle Scout discovered Negro League players from his hometown and secured their place in history.
My name's Gordon Smith. I'm 15, and I go to Mount DeSales Academy.
Gordon, a baby-faced shortstop, is one of the few African-American players on the JV team. He and the other players take in some serious batting practice on the spring-like afternoon. His love of baseball and a recent family vacation to Missouri led him on a journey to finding his roots.
We went to Kansas City, and we went to the Negro League Museum there, and I had an idea Well, I had a thought if any Negro League players were from Macon. So when I came home, we did our research, and I found that there were four, and I wanted to honor them.
So we set out to find these men. With the help of the museum in Kansas City, Gordon identified Lemuel Hawkins and Marion Kane, who are now deceased. He also found Robert Scott, an earnest big dog fan. That nickname has stuck with fans since he was 6 years old, after a kid in the neighborhood decided Ernest just wouldn't do.
He said, "We not gonna call you Ernest." So that sounds like a girl's name. He said, "You are bigger than we are, so we gonna call you Big Dog."
Fan now lives in Alabama, but after talking to Gordon, he traveled home to Macon and joined Scott, who lives in the city, for a ceremony honoring the four Maconites who played in the Negro Leagues. As part of an Eagle Scout project, Gordon raised money for the four plaques that now hang on the walls at Macon's Luther Williams Field. No team currently plays at the park, but it is the second oldest minor league stadium in the country and is full of history. Williams Field was the setting for the major motion picture 42, a biopic about Jackie Robinson, a former Negro League player who broke Major League Baseball's color barrier. Like Robinson, Big Dog played Negro League baseball before transitioning to the major leagues. He's now in his 70s, wearing a burgundy jacket with a Negro League patch on it and a baseball hat. And he still looks like he could throw a fastball fast.
Right now, it hit me that what I did was important. And that's one of the greatest feelings you can have, to know that you went through life and was an impact on a country. That's a good feeling, and I feel great right now.
There are lots of layers to the story of black baseball.
Ray Doswell is the curator of the Kansas City Negro Leagues Museum in Missouri. He helped Gordon find Big Dog and the others. Doswell says a lot of history is top-down, think your high school history class. But much of history comes from the bottom up. The Negro Leagues is a part of that bottom-up history.
There's a lot of interest in the history. It's obviously a lot of interest in baseball still and sport, and that's a motivation for a lot of communities to try to dig up and mine their archives and people for information about, well, do we have great baseball greats here? Do we have a connection to this great broader story? And the young man tapped into that, and he's provided a great example for other communities to do the same.
Gordon says he'd like to play professional baseball one day, and after he retires, he'd like to be a marine biologist. And Gordon says finding the four Negro League players from his hometown gives him the drive to follow his own dreams. For GPB News, I'm Leah Fleming in Macon.
Now let's take a moment to remember one of Atlanta's Negro League team players. James Red Moore died earlier this year at the age of 99. He was believed to be the last surviving member of the Atlanta Black Crackers. And here he is speaking during a panel at Georgia Perimeter College.
We played for the love of the game, you understand that? Instead, we didn't make any money, but we were what you call the trailblazers or the catalysts, pioneers for all these our black ball players.
For more on our look back at the Negro League, visit gpbnews.org. Now, it's been a pretty tough season for Major League Baseball fans in Atlanta. In fact, one of the worst seasons on record for the Braves. But a totally different story south of us for the Savannah Bananas. The amateur team debuted this year and went on to win the Coastal Plains League Championship over the summer. The Bananas also broke the league's season attendance record with more than 90,000 fans. Producer Taylor Gant spoke with two of the Bananas' number one fans. They share their favorite moments from the past season.
I'll tell you, I went to every ball game. I watched the Bananas play. I still love my Atlanta Braves, but hey, I'm a Banana fan for sure. My name is Greg Miller. I live here in Savannah. Been a fan of baseball my entire life, and I'm old enough to remember when Dale Murphy played for the Savannah Braves team. So I've watched a lot of baseball at Grayson Stadium over the years. And to see 4,000 people standing and cheering and to hear that stadium rocking.
And he dives! And he's got it! He's got it! And the Bananas are CPL champions!
I don't know that that's ever happened in that stadium at any point in time. And I remember looking around and going, you know, wow, what a moment in the history of Savannah baseball, the town that was defined as not being a baseball town, has suddenly become an awesome baseball town. And it's these crazy yellow uniforms with the banana running around. That's what brought it here. That was when it just kind of hit that this is a pretty big deal.
As Sharp, the PA announcer, Grayson says, the bases are full of bananas.
My name is Sally Yarber, and I live on Tybee Island. My husband and I had season tickets to the Savannah Bananas this year, and we absolutely love this season. When we had the other team here, they played twice as many games, and so they were gone a lot. There was no accessibility. We couldn't have any interaction with the boys. Now, where my husband and I sit is right behind the catcher, and so we can see them, we know them, we have clappers, so we're noisy and they know who we are. But when we would see them out in the community, they were always friendly. They would talk to you, you'd ask them where they were from. It was just a totally different kind of group of boys.
Let's go, Banana! Let's go, Banana!
They always had a thing called a home run hitter, and they would get a child generally. Who was really too young to play ball, and he would hit the ball off the tee. And then the players deliberately would overthrow or miss a ball or take too long, and the little child got to run from home plate to first, second, third, and back to home. But one night, they had a young man in a wheelchair, and he was being pushed by one of the players. And this fella got to hit the ball and make a home run. And then at the end, you get to keep the ball, and he walks through doing high fives with all of the players. It was just so moving for me as a mother and a grandmother. But anybody watching that had to have been moved. It was just wonderful.
Savannah Banana fans Sally Yarber and Greg Miller. The team won the Coastal Plains League Championship this summer during its inaugural season.
Mm-hmm.